We want to understand what he means by dumbfounding and how that fits into a story he's telling about intuition. And I think we need to kind of get clear about that's the core, one of the core things in the chapter. And then the second thing I want to focus on is the social intuitionist model, which comes up at the end of the chapter. And it's not, you know, this is just not, my experience with this is it's not easy to get this on your own. It's this diagram here. Do you remember that? No? Okay. So I'll try to get that clear, make that clear. And then we have two other study questions for the Kant book. Okay. So I want to basically do three things. These are the reading notes, but I want to basically do three things. I want to cover, and you can kind of do these stepwise with me. The first thing I want to do is just go through a little bit of the intellectual history that he's telling at the first part of the chapter and just remind you of that a little bit, because that's kind of the background. And then the second thing is really this section that begins in evolutionary psychology and moral psychology, and that's kind of some of the fun stuff in the chapter, like the roach juice experiment and the soul selling. And we'll get back to the incest stories. And then the last thing is the social intuitionist model. So let's just kind of take each one stepwise, okay? Feel free to interrupt with questions, but this part will be pretty directed, and then we have a small group thing to do at the beginning of the Kant part, okay? But there's plenty of opportunity for you to come in on this, so please don't. And keep the book out and keep the chapter handy. So we get that. Okay. So where I want to pick up the history is really with social Darwinism. Have any of you run across this phrase? Okay. So social Darwinists were the first people who tried to apply Darwinian thinking to society. They say, well, if Darwin's right, what does that tell us about how we ought to organize society? And social Darwinism was a disaster. It was the first time we really tried to take into account evolution in relation to society, and it produced a really horrible theory. And the theory went like this. If evolution tells us that life is a struggle for survival, then maybe that's really what's happening in society. And maybe that's what we ought to go with. So the point for your notes would be, maybe Darwin's telling us that we ought to think about life as a struggle for survival. And maybe we ought not to help the poor, because maybe they're not meant to survive. Yikes, I know, you feel it? But it, you feel the logic of it too? You just have to imagine people think, oh wow, evolution, that's, you know, this is the new theory. Maybe it means that our morality should be patterned on evolution. That's the core intuition of social Darwinism. And this, you know, this was a horrible, mean-spirited, ultimately racist way to think, because if entire groups aren't doing well, remember this is the end of the 19th century. This is a time when white Europe was encountering the rest of the world through anthropologists who traveling to different places. So maybe if you encounter a group of people as a group that aren't thriving, maybe they're just not meant to survive. The hell with them. That doesn't sound like morality, right? But that was the first effort to connect evolution or naturalism. Let's also say we're talking about naturalism here. I think I defined this already, but naturalism is the belief that in this case, naturalism would be the belief that morality and social life does come out of our biology. Shall I repeat that for you? Naturalism is the belief that morality and our social life comes out of our biology. Right? So naturalists are committed to this idea that there's some connection between our biology, which, you know, is understood in evolutionary terms, and society. Okay, are we good? We got that? All right. So you can see where this... So the first effort at a naturalism that takes Darwin into account produced this horrible mistake. And what Pike wants to say is that that led to a kind of anti-nativism or anti-naturalism. And there are other forces that reinforce this anti-nativism, including a kind of a 60s ideology that said that a lot of our problems had to do with our natural history. And when we can free ourselves from that, that's a morally liberating thing. So one example would be contraception, right? Because with contraception, we aren't tied to the morality of our reproductive cycle anymore. We can make a decision about who to have sex with without having sexual sex. Oops, what happened? without thinking about the ethics of reproduction, right? Likewise, 60s feminism rightly pointed out that natural history is a history of patriarchy. I mean, what could there be in our natural history that would help liberate us morally, right? It looks like our natural history, does that sound right? Our natural history is, to some extent, the latest theory I've read about this is from a Stanford anthropologist who said, since agriculture, he dates patriarchy kind of from agriculture. He says hunter-gatherers were probably not in a patriarchal configuration, but agriculture brings in a premium on physical labor, and anyway, he's got a whole story about that. So anyway, the point is that that social Darwinism, 60s ideology about liberating ourselves from our biology, which coincided with technology that helped us do that. Feminism, which rightly pointed out that our natural history is a patriarchal history and not obviously a role model for us. All of that was part of anti-nativism. So when somebody like E.O. Wilson comes along, the famous biologist, originally he was an ant guy, like he studied ants. But E.O. Wilson's most famous book, well, he's written quite a few, he's kind of an old guy now, Sociobiology. When Wilson comes along in the 70s and says, hey, you know, I'm a biologist, and I think there's some pretty, I've been studying ants for a long time, and I think there's some pretty persuasive evidence that social life in humans, while different from social life for ants, is related to our biology. Get that in your notes. E.O. Wilson was a controversial figure because he revives nativism. He revives the idea that maybe our social life grows out of our biological life. Right? And you know his talks are protested. People are just like screaming, "No, this can't be right." For all the reasons I went into. Sociobiology seemed as wrong-headed to a lot of people as social Darwinism, because it seemed to be saying that our morality was somehow tied to our biological history. And how could that be? But you have to remember, he's doing this in 1975, if I'm not mistaken. And a lot of the developments that we're reading about in this course under the heading of evolutionary psychology, moral psychology, social psychology, a lot of that research, most of the research you're going to read in this course is after this time. So we just hadn't worked out a plausible story, and he was beginning to do that, okay? So that's the intellectual history that you need to know. And the point, the conclusion that Haidt draws on that from that is on page 33 in my book. Let me just kind of get it correlated for you. This is the section called The Emotional 90s. It's like two pages, and it's got the, it mentions Franz de Waal, who we will read. He's a primatologist, and he's going to be telling us about empathy in primates. So he's in the same spirit as E.O. Wilson. And it mentions Damasio, who we encountered in the earlier Haidt reading, The Divided Self. Do you remember Damasio from that? Could you go back in your notes? Or it's also on this page, on this section, The Emotional 90s. Could you just take a minute and see if a couple of you could summarize Damasio's evidence and why Haidt thinks it's important. Let's just take a minute. It's right. What's the page number for that section in the paper? 39. Right. Take it. Let's give it a minute. Give it a minute. I don't want to keep talking. Okay, so what did Damasio show with these? What did he learn from these patients? Could somebody start us off with that? Yeah, please, Kim.
Can I talk about that gut feeling? It's like code that's translated into a part of our brain. It helps us make decisions. But with those, the new damaged part of your brain, that gets turned off. So you can't really weigh any options because all the options seem the same, like kind of equal significance. Like no option seems better than the other.
Yeah. So his patients had to give us more detail. Okay. Good. Yeah. So his patients had damage to the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, and so they couldn't experience their emotions. And then when he gave them a task, and this involved like selecting a washing machine, he gave them a task. They had trouble making a decision about this. And this is one detail. He has a lot of other research to suggest this, and other researchers since have confirmed these findings. But the point you need for your notes is that Damasio's research seems to Haidt to show that emotion and reason aren't separate. That I'm going to give you a couple of results, so I'm going to wait for you to write. Damasio's research seems to suggest that emotion and reason aren't separate. You can't think well if you can't feel well. You can't feel your emotions. And that supports the claim in this part of the book, right, which is intuitions first, reason second. So Damasio's research seems to support Haidt's claim that Plato was wrong, that reason isn't in charge of the emotions. Reason needs emotional life to work. That's a really powerful conclusion. It reverses about 2,000 years of philosophy. A lot of philosophers aren't real happy about that, by the way. But I think it's great. You know, I think we've got a lot of research that seems to suggest that this is right. So Plato's view that reason is separate, and we're going to find this in Kant too, because he says that philosophers have had a rationalist delusion, and here's what he means: we philosophers have been deluded into thinking that reason was this special capacity that we had that didn't come from nature, right? That is the seat of what's valuable about our ability to think. And this doesn't seem to be true. This seems to be a delusion in light of the evidence. It turns out that the best theories, in my opinion, and I'm reflecting the opinion of a lot of researchers, the best theory is that our rational capacities grow out of our emotional life and are still connected to them. Right? That doesn't mean that reason... Okay, so I'll leave it there. Our rational capacities grow out of our emotional life, our emotional prehistory, right? Remember the divided self, right? We don't start over when we become rational, when we get our prefrontal cortex, when we get our neocortex. Nature doesn't start over. It builds on top of what came before. So reason isn't separate. It doesn't come from some other place besides nature. It's even hard for me now to just imagine that philosophers for so long just thought reason connected us to something outside of nature. Do you see why that's puzzling if you adopt a naturalist perspective? What is outside of nature? And see, the old answer was that society and culture is non-natural. But you can see how an ant guy, or an ant woman, what would that be like, wouldn't share that perspective, because the ants are social, but there's sociality is part of their nature, right? So what happened in the 70s is that we got kind of the tools and the theorizing and the evidence to start thinking about reason as natural, right? So that's a pretty crucial change. Okay, so that's the first part. Now let's get into the evolutionary psychology part. Could somebody remind us of what the Roach juice experiment was? Anybody have that? Keep paging forward. Yes, please.
It was like they boiled, so they had a roach, and they boiled it, and they boiled away all the germs, and like, okay, like, drink it, and then people still had an issue with drinking it, even though it wasn't rationally
going to cause it. Right. So it's a way of, put in your notes, it's a way of seeing the elephant, right? You're seeing intuition. And the way you do it is by, dumbfounded. What about soul selling? What was the soul selling experiment? Thanks, that was great. You got it? Oh, sorry. You gotta watch out. You know, make moves like being in an auction. Right.
I just had a piece of paper that said, like, I sell my soul and whatever his name was, and then at the end it was like, this isn't binding or anything, it's basically a joke,
right.
And you can tear it up.
But people won't.
Didn't want to do it.
Yeah, people tend not to want to do it. Even people who are self-identified atheists don't want to do it. Again, we're triggering. Put it in your notes. We're seeing the elephant. We're showing the intuition, without reason. And this is ultimately dumbfounding. This is what dumbfounding is: the experience of believing something without having a reason for it. When you think you should have a reason, right? So dumbfounding is the experience of believing something that you think you should have a reason for, but not having a reason for it. And the biggest example was really his vignettes on things like incest and so on, right? And you notice how the interviewer, you get a little more detail on that incest research in this section, Why Atheists Won't Sell Their Souls. And you notice the research, the experimenter keeps pushing the dumbfounding strategy, keeps asking, you know, well, so what would be wrong with that? And what you get to is, I don't know, it's just wrong. I mean, there's no way I could change my mind. I don't know, but that's dumbfounding, right? Are you guys with me? Okay. So how do you explain that? What's going on in dumbfounding? This is kind of our second point. So, study question, I think. And this is where he gets into this Margolis research. And Margolis has a theory, let's just kind of do it standalone, it's right, the note's right there. Margolis has a theory that there's a difference between seeing that and reasoning why. So put these as columns, we're going to line up a couple of features with each one. So seeing that is pattern recognition. Reasoning why, and that's automatic. That's part of, remember our automatic versus controlled processes from the divided self chapter? And reasoning why is controlled thought. It's self-conscious thought. What are my reasons? Now, so you're going to do that when you write your papers, right? And what Haidt wants to say is moral intuition is pattern matching first and reasoning second. Intuition's first, reasoning second. So let's make sure we get this clear. Dumbfounding, the experience of dumbfounding, according to Haidt, shows that when we make moral judgments, we are pattern matching. Incest matches to a pattern of like prohibition, right? No. So when the people get the incest vignette, that's what they're doing. Then they bring the reasoning to bear on why it's wrong. And, you know, guess what? The vignette's been written so that there are no rational reasons. There are no rational considerations against it. But we have a deep, the elephant still says, incest, no way. That's wrong. You see the point? Are you with me? Okay. So dumbfounding is the experience, and Margolis's theory is an attempt to explain it. And that's what's going on with the Wasson card. I don't think we have time to get into the Wasson card thing, but Margolis' research helps explain why people get the Wasson card experiment wrong. Because they're matching a pattern, but the logic, the Wasson card experiment really is a logical problem, but people get it wrong because they respond with their elephant and they make a pattern matching. And when you do pattern matching with the Wasson card, you come up with two answers, but you come up with the wrong answer. one right answer, one wrong answer. That's a part that, you know, if we had a little more time, we would have gone into. So if you just make a note, make sure you go back and understand the Wasson card thing. I think he explains it pretty clearly, but it's a puzzle. If you have trouble with it, I'll go through it again on Monday. Okay, so we're almost done with height, and where we are is, well, let's draw some conclusions, right? Height thinks he's supporting the idea that intuition comes first and reasoning second, so that's the first conclusion. Second conclusion, though, is that emotions are a form of cognition. That's very challenging. Let's just take a minute and think about this together. Emotions are a form of cognition. Intuition is a form of emotional cognition. So emotion and reason are both forms of cognition. That's very strange. Do you feel how odd that is to say that? Our typical thing is that reason is cognition, emotion is feeling. So our model for emotions, our naive model for emotions is emotions are things we feel. But what Haidt wants to do is say, you know, intuit pattern matching, what the elephant's doing when it locates the incest prohibition is it's making an emotional judgment. Isn't that weird? That should feel a little odd to talk like that, right? But that's how he's using the Margolis research and this idea that intuitions come first to suggest that we actually have an automatic process. It's not non-cognitive. It's actually doing cognitive work. It's pattern matching. Reason can interact with it. So he's not saying we're just stuck with our moral emotions. We can change them, but the interaction isn't what we thought. What philosophers thought was that reason was this special thing that we had that was not part of nature, and that's where all the cognition happened. And the model we're moving to now, remember that point about how you have 100 million neurons in your gut? What we're moving now to is a model where we have two processes, and you psychologists in the room know this from your psychology studies, sometimes called system two. We have two systems, the automatic system and the controlled system. And reason is part of the controlled system, but the automatic system is making judgments for us. It's matching our experience to patterns that we have, like incest and prohibition. Okay, that's the second. So the first conclusion, intuition's first, set reasoning second. Second conclusion, emotion and reason are both forms of cognition. And finally, this is the pay dirt, right? The social intuitionist model. And that chart is very complicated. I don't want to use it. I think a simpler way to do it is to just give you the basic idea. But if you have the book handy, go ahead and open it up to this. Because the chart does make sense. It's just a little complicated. Let me tell you what it's trying to do. The social intuitionist model is a way of capturing how elephants and riders interact socially. I'll say it again. The social intuitionist model is Haidt's effort to explain how social life involves. No, I'm sorry. How did I say it the first time?
Capturing how elephants and riders.
Yeah, that's the thing. How the elephant and rider in us interact with others, elephants and riders. This is kind of fun, though, if you think about it with me. In social interaction, what's happening every time we have a social interaction is that the elephant is interacting first. And that's sometimes called chemistry. It's sometimes, you could think of it as a quick intuitive judgment about whether this person is somebody who gets me. Like, is this somebody that I am sympathetic with? Do you know, does that make sense? We're going to see later, we're going to see some researches. Haidt and others would say we're always making judgments. It's just that we're not always doing it rationally. A lot of times it's happening kind of subconsciously. So here's what he wants to say. In social life, we react first, the elephants react first, and reason comes in afterwards. And the way to make this concrete is to say, ultimately, who are you going to take criticism from? Are you going to take criticism from someone who you don't have an intuitive connection with? Or are you more likely to take criticism from someone who you think you identify with at some level intuitively?
Get it.
You see the point? Does that make sense? I mean, think about how mentoring relations... I'll kick it off, but I want you guys to come up with examples or questions if you don't see it. Mentoring relationships, right? You don't set up mentoring programs by telling people who their mentor's going to be. Ideally, you kind of figure out who you would see as a mentor first. Does that make sense? And isn't it true in your experience that the people you're most likely to listen to reason from are the people who you think kind of get you at an intuitive level? So could we get a little more nonverbal on this?
Yes,
thank you. That's great. That's very good nonverbal. Could you give me some examples of that? Does this make sense to say that intuition... Notice it's part of intuition comes first, reasoning second. What it's saying is that in social life, it's the elephants that get together first. You see? It's kind of a weird way to talk.
Yeah.
But those are the people that you're going to listen to reason from. So what Haidt is saying is reason comes into play, but our willingness to listen to reasons depends upon the intuitive connection first. Does that sound right? Yeah.
It's kind of like how people will receive things better if they feel good. Like if you make someone feel good and then give them criticism, they're going to be much more inclined to take it.
Yeah. Notice, actually, I hadn't thought about this. It's an obvious connection, but thanks for your comment. Remember, we're going to be doing peer review, right? So the peer review is going to go better if I'm going to accept peer criticisms better if I think the person has appreciated what I'm doing right. That's why you should make some positive comments when you give peer evaluation. The problem most people have is that that's all they give. I mean, I've looked at a lot of your peer evaluation. Our tendency is, why enter conflict? The anonymity is supposed to help us a little bit. But yeah, that's a good example. You're going to take criticism from someone who thinks that you're more likely to take criticism from someone who you think appreciates what you do well.
Like you intuitively feel good, you're
absolutely.
Intuitively feel good.
Absolutely.
Like,
yeah.
Like,
yeah. And encountering reasons and people challenging us, why did you do that? I don't think that's the right thing to do. That's a challenging situation. So you're gonna listen to that from someone who you identify with. That's kind of the point here. Okay, so do you see what the social intuitionist model is? An attempt to model how does social life work? How do reason and intuition interact socially, given what we've said about them, how they work in an individual? Okay, I think we can leave that there. We're gonna develop, we're gonna be reading the rest of the book, we're gonna come back to this, and it's gonna get developed a lot. Okay, so let's make a transition. Is that okay? Can we make a transition here? Yeah, please.
I was a little bit confused when reading how that works in terms of like how we determine each other's elephants kind of thing.
Yeah.
When you think it within the context, there's that kind of understanding that we tend to like gravitate towards people who are like more similar to us.
Good.
But kind of the context within like what assumptions we make about other people's
good. Good. That's a really good question. You see what she's asking? How does that work? We're going to get a big story about that, so I'm not going to give you a big long answer now. But the short answer would be, think about how you identify with people politically. Like, you say, you see these problems the way I do. You see a harm here. You see this is about loyalty. So part of it is similar to the part of the how in your question. The answer is that it's kind of similar to the way we connect with people about some very basic things about how we see the world. Like, where are the dangers? Where are the harms? What should we be for? What should we be against? And a lot of those, Haidt wants to say, a lot of those are very intuitive judgments.
So what I was confused with is, like, can they be trained? Can the elephants be trained?
Absolutely. Good. You know, in a way, what the social intuitionist model is saying is, yes, the elephants can be trained, but only mostly by reason coming from people whose elephant I identify with. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I have been influenced by a lot of people in my life. So have you, right? What Heidi's trying to say is you're going to be rationally influenced by people who you already have an intuitive connection with or who you think get you. I think the phrase get you is kind of helpful here. Do you use that phrase? Like somebody gets you? Right. That's the elephant connecting. They get me. Doesn't mean there's a lot, that doesn't mean that you're like me. It just means that I think you're kind of intuiting how I am over here. So if you have a criticism to offer, I'm more likely to hear it now. That's kind of the point. Good. Okay, let's transition to Kant. And here I'm going to set up a very intuitive exercise. You don't need to know anything about Kant to do this. I want you to get into small groups, and I want you to try to identify what it means to treat someone as a person. And you can imagine, I'll give you a little more of a prompt than that, but imagine an alien's come down and they're trying to figure out this part of human life, you know. So I didn't treat you as a person. What does that mean? So that's the prompt. Try to figure out what does it mean if you were trying to explain to someone who didn't understand what it meant to treat people like persons, how would you do it? What concepts would you use? Yeah.
Do you mean like versus the utilitarian, thought of as a means for something.
Yeah, good. No, that does come into play, but I mostly mean, as a person versus a thing.
Oh.
Like, what does it mean to treat you as a person versus to just treat you as a creature in my world? You know? And I want to give you this one example. Imagine that you had tried to go to a lake out in the countryside, and you had to drive 20, 30, 40 miles to get to this lake. And bad thing happened. It turns out the road was closed because of an avalanche. So you go back, you drive back, and you're at this gas station. Your day's ruined. You didn't get to the lake. And you're at this gas station, and you overhear somebody else getting gas, and they're saying, well, won't it be great when we get to the lake? And you don't say anything. And do we all agree that's a pretty crappy thing to do? Okay. That might be kind of, if you work through that example, why is that a crappy thing to do? Not tell the person that, hey, you're going to drive 20 miles, 30 miles, and then you're going to find out that the road's closed? Haha, I'll just let you do it. So get in your groups, use that as, and maybe that'll be a prompt that would help you figure it out, because I think that's crappy in a way that gets at treating people like persons, okay? So go ahead and do that, and keep a list of other things you come up with. 5 to 7 minutes. We could start with why would it be morally crappy to, that's becoming a technical term in the course now, why would it be morally crappy to not tell the person about the avalanche? Yeah.
Because you're making them feel the same crappy way that you felt.
Yeah, you're making them unhappy.
Yeah.
That would be one possible answer. Yeah, that would be a utilitarian answer, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're not promoting the greatest good for the greatest number. It doesn't cost you anything to tell them. You're standing at the pump, right? You know? What else? Is there a reason why it's a crappy thing to do that doesn't have to do with not promoting their happiness? I mean, that's one problem with it morally. Yeah.
It has to do with the respect that all humans deserve the same respect.
But... Yeah. Yeah. Would it make sense to say, look, I don't care whether this makes you happier or not. I just think you need to know this.
Yeah.
You know, and why is that? Why is it that treating someone as a person means thinking about what they need to know? And one answer would be because we're creatures that have goals and plans, and that's part of what it means to be a person, right? You lose something important about personhood when you can't do this. Let's say you become catatonic or you persist in vegetative state, right? We still treat you as a person, but that's one of the signature marks of an active person. So what else? So when you in your groups, so let's leave the example aside. I think that's right. It's that even if you're not, you could, it could be crappy because you're not promoting the greatest good for the greatest number, but it could also be a crappy thing to do because you're not treating the person as someone who is a source of rational plans, has a day that they've planned, and needs to know this. You know, so you're not honoring that about them. What else came up in your groups, though, aside from this example? What does it mean to treat someone as a person? Yeah.
We talked about like the libertarian view of self-ownership.
Yeah.
Like, if you treat a waiter bad, it's because, well, not because, but they're kind of owned by the restaurant, they're owned by their bosses, versus like someone
who's
owned.
I mean, we don't talk about, we don't worry about exploiting things, right? You don't. Do you ever worry about whether you're taking advantage of your laptop? I mean, you know, you don't worry about exploiting things. You worry about exploiting people. And why is that? Because people seem to be bearers of rights. I mean, wouldn't that be one of the things you'd tell the alien? That, you know, treating someone like a person involves treating them like a bearer of rights. And suppose the alien said, oh, is that because rights make people happy? And you say, well, yeah, that's what utilitarians say. That's, you know. But is it always true that treating people as bearers of rights, that means, you know, people who have rights, is it always true that when you treat someone as having rights, you're promoting their immediate happiness? Give me an example of respecting someone's rights, but not necessarily promoting their happiness. This is a really important category, so let's take a minute and do this. Give me examples of respecting someone's rights, but where the situation wouldn't necessarily lead to their happiness. Yeah.
Kind of trivial, but like if someone like had something stuck in their teeth and then you pointed it out, they'd be like, you know, super embarrassed. But then like, I know it's really trivial. But
yeah, no, that's. I mean, there are things that we do that we where we say, I think this person wants to know this, would want to know this,
but
it's
like, don't,
it's.
But they do.
It's going to hurt a little bit,
yeah.
Like, you know, by the way, you know, your fly's down or you've got stuff in your teeth or whatever, yeah. Good, that's a good start.
I was going to say if, like, you had a friend, had, like, two friends and that were dating each other and you knew that one of them was, like, cheating on the other one, and so you, like, told the one that was getting
because
cheated
you thought,
on, or you told them you were going to tell the other one.
Yeah,
or something.
It's similar to your example. It's like you have a right to know this, but this is not going to make you happy. Good.
Yeah.
Can we think of another example? That's a good one. It has a lot of human interest. I mean, anytime you acknowledge that you can't control someone, that they, part of what it means to have rights is that you control aspects of your destiny, right? So anytime you acknowledge that you can't control someone, you can only advise them, you're treating them as a person, you're treating them as a bearer of rights, and treating them that way may not make them happy. They might make a really bad decision. So the point for your notes is that rights give us the freedom to make really horrible decisions. Right? So respecting people as bearer... I'll let you write. Rights give us the freedom to make really bad decisions. And when I respect your right, I'm respecting that in part, right? So respecting a person's rights, treating someone as a person, respecting their rights, and making them happy aren't always the same thing, right? I mean, Mill might be right that having rights in the long run of human history makes people happy, but in the immediate situation where you're trying to figure out how to treat someone as a person, that means, you know, recognizing that you don't control them. And you can't make them happy. All you can do is give them the room to make a decision which may or may not make them happy. Okay? Give an example.
That's kind of thinking kind of like dealing with adolescents.
Yeah, I did that, actually. and sometimes with... Yeah, that's a good example. You have to let people make mistakes sometimes. And why? You suppose the alien said, why? Why would you want to let people make mistakes? That's a bad thing. You're trying to explain, well, we're humans. We treat each other, we're not just creatures. We treat each other as persons. So as creatures, we're just things, right? We're just like other animals. But, right?
We're not property.
Yeah, yeah. We're not controlled with something that can be controlled. That's what it means to treat someone as a person, is to treat them as having freedom, right? But that means that sometimes treating people that way means letting them do stupid things. Right? Say, oh, don't do that, don't do that. Oh, but it's up to you. Right?
So, I don't know, just to bring in an additional element.
Good, absolutely.
What about when you kind of inform someone of something that is also out of their control? You know, like informing someone that you think that they are, like, addicted to something.
Yeah.
And that addiction would maybe be without, it's like a mental thing, so out of their control.
Right.
Like, where would that fall?
That's a good point. No, that's a good example. Yeah. Because we care about people. I mean, part of treating, you're bringing up an interesting point, which is that we've taken a very formal approach to what it means to treat someone as a person. But there's another way to think about it where you say, well, what does it mean to care about someone? And to care about someone, you might do that, right? You might say, well, I respect that you, as long as you say, well, I respect that you may or may not agree with what I'm about to tell you, but we've all come here, imagine an intervention, right? We've all come here to tell you that we're concerned about you, right? That's caring about someone, right? So you can do that and still treat them as a person if you acknowledge that they get to make the next move, right? They get to say, thank you very much. I don't want to talk to you about this ever again.
So
that's what am I right? That's what it means to have rights. Is to, you know, people come to you and say, "Oh, we care about you. We don't want you to do this thing you're doing. You're doing drugs. You're drinking too much." You know, yeah, fair enough. You care about me, and now I'm a person. I have rights, so I can accept or reject your advice, right?
So, but within that situation, you obviously know that person really well. So, if you are coming across like a similar situation where you can tell someone you're addicted but you don't know someone very well, like say, same situation, just overhearing, and you hear that someone has had like 12 packs of cigarettes today or something. You know,
something horrible.
Something,
you know,
along those lines.
But you don't have the relationship to intervene.
Yeah,
right.
We don't, that like the, I don't know, the normal human interactions, you don't intervene in that situation, I would say. Like normally if you because you don't know the full story or whatnot, so where does that come from?
That's neat. You know, you're getting us, you're moving us in a different, interesting direction, which is like, how do you, this is good, you're sort of asking, in the course of social relationships, how do you know when you can go beyond the formal way of treating someone as a person? And it has to do with intimacy and knowledge, right? But as far as we're concerned, what we're doing now here is just saying, what does it mean to treat someone as a person? Where's the line between what you can or can't do? And we're thinking about people in general, not special relationships like friendships. Okay, I want to make a 10-minute push here. Are we ready? You guys have the energy? Let's do this. Let's get to Kant. We haven't quite gotten to Kant yet, but this is really about half the work. Because once you realize that treating someone as a person doesn't always involve making them happy, you're in a position to see Kant's insight. Here it is. Ready? So put Kant on your notes now. We're going to start talking about Kant. Kant's fundamental claim about morality is that it can't have anything to do with making people happy. It cannot. It has nothing. And notice how different this is than Aristotle and utilitarians. Remember we said they were eudaimonists because they thought morality and happiness go together, right? Greatest good for the greatest number, greatest happiness. Kant is our first example of a non eudaimonistic or non-happiness moral theory. Morality has nothing to do with making people happy. Why? Because that all comes from nature. Nature gives us desires, inclinations that lead us to pursue our happiness. There's no freedom in that. This is very strange, but just follow me a few steps. And then morality can't be about happiness because happiness has to do with our desires and inclinations, and we get those from nature. They don't have to do with reason or freedom. Wow. So, get that in your notes. You feel the distinction he's drawing here? Kant is a non-nativist. He's a non-naturalist. He doesn't think reason or human freedom come from nature. By the way, he's like a couple hundred years before. No, he's like 100, almost 200 years before Darwin.
So would this kind of be like, is it kind of like the Darwinian view the rationalist delusion?
Yeah, good. That's a good connection to make. I mean, when Haidt looks at this, he's saying, wow, this is putting reason, this is imagining that reason doesn't come from nature. Wow. Okay, how could that be? Okay, but for the moment, let's just follow this thought. So you're right to make that connection. So if morality can't come from our desires and inclinations, what can it come from? And his answer is, morality is about treating each other as rational and free people. It's about treating each other as persons. So put in your notes the first way. Morality is about treating each other as rational and free people. It's about treating you as autonomous. Remember autonomy? It's about treating you as a source of law for yourself. So nature is on this side. Nature gives us inclinations. Nature is heteronomous. Nature gives us laws that come from outside of us, heteronomous, right? Outside of, it's a law coming from outside of us rather than a law coming from us. Remember this little three-part distinction I made between motives, acts, and consequences, right? And so virtue ethics is an act-based theory and utilitarian is a consequence-based theory. Kant is a motive-based theory. He thinks what makes something moral is the motive or will that it comes from, not the consequences that it produces. And the way you know your will is through a maxim which expresses it, which is saying what your motive is, okay? Okay, so now we're ready to connect the dots. We need 5 minutes to do this. Kant wants to say that maxims that are hypothetical have this form. If you want X, do Y. Anytime you formulate a maxim for your action that has to do with desires and inclinations, you're engaging in this kind of hypothetical maxim. You're saying, if I want a good job, I better get a college degree. If I want this, I better do that, right? Everything that you do, every motive you have that is related to your desires and inclinations is hypothetical. Get that in your notes. Every motive that you have that's related to your desires and inclinations is hypothetical. Every motive that you have that is related to your desires and inclinations is hypothetical. And because of that, it can't be moral. Remember, he said, stuff that comes from nature, desire, that's all, there's no freedom there, there's no reason there. He's made this incredible distinction between nature and reason, between nature and freedom. You know how crazy this free will idea is? In Kant's time, philosophers thought free will meant that you had to be the uncaused. Your action had to be uncaused. That's crazy. But that's sort of the way we think about free will, or that's the way we used to think about free will. So if these maxims can't be moral, because they come from desire and inclination where there's no freedom and there's no reason, what would it mean for a maxim to be categorical? It would just look like this. Because you can always, with hypothetical maxim, you can always say, well, if you don't want that, then you don't have to do Y. But what Kant's looking for is a kind of duty that we have no matter what we want. And it's a duty to promote the idea of us as rational creatures. Okay, here's how I'm going to just get you as far as the first formulation. So there are three formulations of the categorical imperative. We're going to study two. The first formulation goes like this. It's right on the screen here. Don't try to write all this down now. You just need your concentration for a couple minutes, and we're going to go over this again on Monday. The first formulation is, act only on those maxims you can will as universal law, okay? And you can follow the text with me if you want, but I'm just going to give you the example. Suppose, you remember this from your reading, suppose you need a loan really badly, but you can't pay it back. Remember this from the reading? Can you make a maxim that says, basically, whenever you're in a situation where you need something, you can make a false promise? Yeah. Why can't you universalize that? See, Kant wants to say, you act on those maxims that you can universalize, you can imagine as a universal law. What would be wrong if the whole world followed your maxim? Whenever you need money, make a false promise. That's the crucial point. See, the other answer is it would be an unhappy world. Am I right? It would probably be an unhappy world if people always told lies and kept false and didn't make promises. But that's not Kant's point. Kant's point is what she said. Say it again.
It would contradict itself
because if
someone said, I will loan you money, and then they didn't do it, then it's just like this whole cycle of people wanting money but never giving it or getting
right.
it.
And let's focus on the first part of what you said. If you try to universalize the maxim of a false promise, you get a contradiction because you're saying that there should be things like promises, but they don't have to mean anything. You're willing an irrational world. Oh my God! You see that? Why that's the worst thing you could do for Kant. It doesn't matter whether your actions make people happy or not. It matters whether they realize the idea of yourself and others as a rational creature. It's the same reason it's a shitty thing. Excuse me. It's a bad thing not to tell the people about the avalanche, right? Because you're kind of undermining the idea of them as rational people. They've got plans, and so you're not respecting that. So Kant's interest in how should we talk to this is kind of the last note you need to take here. Let's see if we can make it a good one. I mean, I'll take your time. We have 5 minutes for questions. I want to stop on this. Kant's arguing that you have a categorical duty to act rationally and to treat others as rational. And that duty is separate from making people happy. You don't have a duty to make people happy. Wow, you see how he's going to disagree with Singer? Wow, totally different. You don't have a moral duty is not a duty to make people happy. Moral duty is about realizing the image of ourselves as rational and free people. And that's a categorical duty. It has nothing to do with your inclinations. Does that make sense? That's a really solid result. I mean, I don't mind if we didn't get to the second one because we have a little time on Monday. But do you see then how, make sure this is clear in your notes. We have time to mull this over right now. You see how Kant is establishing morality wholly separate from nature. Morality has nothing to do with our existence as natural creatures who have evolved and are in a social relationships with each other. It has nothing to do with morality. Morality is about realizing something about us that has nothing to do with nature, our rational nature, which he thinks comes wholly from outside of nature. And that's part of the reason Haidt is saying, this is kind of a rationalist delusion. What we know now about humans suggests that our reason did actually evolve with our brains, and so the separation he's making between reason and nature, frankly, as a philosopher, I just have to tell you, doesn't make sense anymore to me, it's really profound. And if you didn't know about evolution, it might be where you would wind up, but Kant still got a really powerful moral theory because we do treat each other as persons, and when we do treat each other as persons, we don't always worry about making each other happy, right? We said that tonight. So Kant's theory still has a pull on us, even though the underlying metaphysics looks a little crazy if you're a naturalist. Like, if you think that we are really creatures that come out of nature. Okay, let's stop there. Yeah. Stick around if you have questions. Yeah.
So where does Kant think that the rationality comes from? Is it simply the divine characteristics?
He says we can't know, but all we can know is that it doesn't come from.